This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
The Leader of the Opposition rightly asked what conversations we're having with business and also what preparation we're making to deal with the economic challenges we face. I would say, look, we are in a strong position to meet these challenges because we've paid down so much of our deficit, we've had strong growth and job creation, but I don't belittle at all the consequences will be difficult. There are going to be some very choppy waters ahead. I don't resile from any of the warnings I made during the referendum campaign, but we've got to find the best way through this. Now, one of the things we must do is talk with businesses and reassure them about the stability there is today and the strength of the British economy. The business secretary has met with a whole range of businesses already. Tomorrow I have the meeting of my business advisory group, and I'm inviting other companies to that, including Siemens, who play a huge role in the British economy. And what we need to talk about is the reassurances about stability we can give now, the fact that our circumstances don't change until we leave the European Union, and then I want to hear from them as we draw up the possible blueprints for Britain's future position with Europe about what they think would be the right answer.
Well, there is the very familiar voice of British Prime Minister David Cameron speaking after the Brexit vote last Thursday, and of course everybody knew by Friday morning what was happening. You would swear it was going to be the end of the world. Everything looked like it was in meltdown mode on Friday and Monday, and of course there had been no end of dire predictions about what this was going to mean should the Brexit vote be a vote in favor of leave. But now we've come through the entire week, and Jim, hold and below, as I say, the markets are acting like nothing happened, despite all of the dire predictions and George Soros saying the EU was in mortal danger.
Yeah, I would say, John, of all the things that happened, I mean, in between Friday, we were down 600 points, down almost 300 points on the Dow on Monday. So we had a 1,000-point drop. The S&P got down below 1,900. And here we are right back up to almost 2,100. So we're only 4 points away. We're doing this program on a Thursday ahead of the holidays. But the only leftover effects that continue the trend, John, are bond yields and also what's happening to gold. Gold is around 1325, so gold is holding up strong. As you heard in the first hour, our technicians feel like we're in a bull market, that we're probably going to end up over time taking out the old highs reached back in September of 2011. But you're right. Within a couple days, we basically reversed what happened in 2 days. So it was like a plunge down and then a rocket ride up. And it happened very quickly. These events, when you think about it, took place over 4 days.
Jim, why do you think we got such a bounce back? I mean, the predictions were pretty dire going in. And from what was happening, you know, people were saying, oh, the pound was taking a dive. And I thought, this is a good time to buy pounds, by the way, along with some of the other stocks. But why the bounce back? Do you think people came to their senses?
Well, no. I think, number one, it's always an initial sell-off and reaction. And you never really, unless you were trading in advance of that, like Soros did, he sold the pound and bought gold. So, you know, he made a lot of money on this and still continues to do that. But it was an initial reaction. And then on top of that, this is a process that's going to take time to play out. So there are a lot broader implications in this rather than the initial vote. Because number one, as Cameron gave in that speech to Parliament on Monday, he said he was going to hold off on invoking Article 50, which begins the process of exiting the euro. He was going to leave that to his successor, whoever that's going to be, in October. So here we are. We're in the latter stage. We're just about to enter the second half of the year in, July, August, September, October. So invoking Article 50 is not going to take place for maybe 4 months, and then that could take place for 2 years. So I think it's like anything else. When something happens, there's an initial shock because a lot of people were expecting, as we talked last week, when I turned on the evening news on Thursday, the newscasts were going that Britain voted to stay. A couple hours later, it was a complete flip-flop. So I think that took a lot of people by surprise, and people that made bets on staying had to go reverse those bets. And that's why I think you saw the violent reaction on Friday, and especially Thursday night in the futures market. So initial reaction on this, John. And then also, we had central banks. The Bank of England said they would basically provide 250 billion pounds of liquidity to the market. You had the Bank of Japan, and you had the U.S. Federal Reserve saying, look, opening up swap lines. And so we didn't have any of the contagion or liquidity risk, because immediately central banks stepped into the fray with liquidity, which means the markets are being kept liquid. So you didn't have any of the risk that we had, let's say, with Lehman. And that's why you saw a lot of comments made in the financial press that this wasn't a Lehman moment. There wasn't a liquidity issue that was up for discussion here. Central banks moved immediately, announcing that, hey, don't worry, market participants, we're going to give you as much liquidity as you want.
We need to examine, I think, the broader implications of this, because there was so much digital ink spilled on all of this, and it was done at various levels as to what people are saying as far as an analysis is going. And so some detangling is in order.
If you take a look at this, we've made comments on the show about the presidential election here in the U.S. It's really a number of broad trends that you're seeing play out. Number one, the reversal of globalization. And basically, you've seen this three-decade trend beginning in the late 70s and beyond for globalization. We're seeing markets that are more integrated. It's one of the reasons why we saw so much action in a 24-hour period, is all these markets are integrated today. Traders all across the globe are looking at the same screens, reacting at the same time. Also, it's going to play out in politics in the EU. So there are a number of things that are going to be coming out here. And I think more importantly, we're seeing that this is changing the political discourse, not only here in the U.S., in Britain, Europe, in Japan. Typically, when you get into a presidential election year or any kind of election year, whether it's the midterm elections, John, usually the debates politically among the populace is conservative versus a liberal agenda, big government versus small government. Now, I think you're going to add a third element in the political discussion. It's going to be free trade versus protectionism. You take a look at Donald Trump. You take a look at the reason to vote for Brexit. A lot of them had to do with immigration. A lot of them had to do with free trade. A lot of job losses. We've seen it in manufacturing here in the U.S. We've seen it overseas. A lot of that has to do with technology, but globalization is getting the brunt of that blame. And I think we're going to start moving to what you're going to see, a strong movement towards nationalism. And you're seeing this in a lot of the political parties that are starting to crop up on the right, whether it's Donald Trump here as a Republican, whether it's Nigel Farage in England, whether it's Le Pen and all the other various parties that are starting to crop up in Europe, that are basically saying, we don't like this. We don't think we benefited, and a lot of people have lost their jobs. And they look at immigration, they look at globalization as the main reason that job growth has been stagnant, wage growth has been stagnant, and they blame the lack of higher wages on globalization, because companies can compete. If labor rates are high in one area of the world, you can simply ship your factory to another part of the world. And so now, I think the broader implications of this is this 3 or 4 decade run that we had in increasing globalization. We'll talk about the implications for that for multinational companies later on in this broadcast. But I think the reversal of globalization and the strong rise of populist movements around the globe, you're seeing it everywhere.
What we need to look at here then are the broader meanings for the political tilt, both from individual countries and then more globally, and then the impact of that on the markets, because we're always talking here about the three-legged stool, politics, technicals, and fundamentals, and you really can't separate these. They are all interactive.
Yeah, and there are much broader implications like this, because one of the things that you're going to be seeing, and we saw it here in the last week, this increase and spike in volatility that took place over 4 days, and what it is going to inject into the markets is something that we don't like. I mean, John, we have spent the last couple of years, 2 years, this will be year 3, talking about Fed policy. the uncertainty injected into the market, beginning with the announcement of taper in 2014. So now, in addition to central bank uncertainty as it relates to the Fed, now you have political uncertainty injected into the market. And I think what you're going to see, and we'll talk about investment strategy later on, is you're going to see a lot of shifts in rotations from the risk off to the risk on trade. We were in the risk on trade until Brexit, then we went into the risk off. Now, with central banks injecting liquidity, which provides fuel to the fire in the markets, you might see initially, and we'll talk about this later on, a deflationary impact, but eventually a reflationary impact. And I think the shock is, this has been an exogenous shock to the economic system. We saw the IMF, the World Bank, lower economic growth rates globally and also here for the U.S. But what this means is, in the short term, you're going to see less openness between countries, so there's a greater risk of trade wars. You're going to see slower economic growth, and you're going to see less predictable policies, because when populism rises as much as it has here in the U.S. and overseas, it becomes unpredictable, because you have people promising and making all kinds of rash statements that have not really been thought out in terms of their economic impact. For example, raising taxes, redistribution, more regulation. You know, people don't realize, I mean, Japan saw the consequences of that. They started a monetary policy to goose the economy. Then the government enacted a tax and the economy went back into recession. So there's a lot of things that are being promised in an election year where voters are angry. They want something to be done. And a lot of times politicians are ignorant. Most of them are ignorant of economics and the decisions that they make, which is typical of Washington. They don't understand the consequences. So we're going to see less predictable policies. And I think the more important thing is the rising clout of what you're seeing in terms of anti-establishment politics. A prime example of what we saw just in the UK, but also what we're seeing play out in this year's election politics, although in the polls right now, Hillary Clinton, the establishment candidate for the media, and the establishment in Washington, she's John ahead in the polls. So even though Donald Trump has taken the political lead and will be the Republican candidate, the establishment candidate, Hillary Clinton, is leading in the polls. So it may be a little bit different here. But I also think you're going to see this over the next 4 or 5 years. You saw it with Bernie Sanders. You saw it with Hillary Clinton. You're also seeing it with Donald Trump. So I don't care who you're talking about in the lead in the political establishment here in the U.S., it is definitely a retreat from globalism. And with the exception of Hillary Clinton, it's also a backlash against immigration, which is one of the key cornerstones of Donald Trump's campaign. And what people don't realize, and this is probably one reason that the markets are a little more sanguine after this, is the UK's decision to leave the European Union means years of uncertainty for bankers, investors, and it's going to be a boom to lawyers. A lot of law firms and accounting firms from Pricewaterhouse are talking about, a lot of their clients are saying, you know, what do we do now? Because obviously there's going to be a 2-year negotiating process on treaties. Will there be tariffs? All of these things are going to have an impact on international business. And it's one of the reasons why in the short run, you're going to see slower economic growth. And don't be surprised as a result of this, as we get second quarter GDP numbers from around the globe. We're going to get the ISM manufacturing numbers. We barely got over 50, which means it's actually growing, because we were down below 50 in the ISM numbers here, meaning that the manufacturing sector was contracting. So we're going to be looking at economic numbers, and I think we'll talk about Fed policy going forward here. But definitely, you're going to see slower economic growth in the short term. And as the economy starts to slow, as job growth begins to slow, as the unemployment rate begins to climb, John, there's going to be a cry to political leaders, fix this, do something about it, even though we know our political leaders have much to do about why the system's breaking down as it is.
As we began the program here, we were listening to David Cameron's speech, and before we got on the air, I was listening to Angela Merkel's address too, trying to address the same issue. Both of them seem to be in the mind that there are going to be some bumps. And in the case of Chancellor Merkel, she said that this is the way Britain's gone and we're just going to have to deal with that and move on. As they move on, they're both saying we're going to have some bumps. What's it going to look like? What are the longer term implications?
Well, if we were to probably frame them, they're really around three items. Number one, what happens next for the UK? Number two, everybody's asking this one and making all kinds of predictions. Who's next in the EU? If Britain is left, who else is coming? And we'll have a little bit of humor in terms of what's happening with various people, in terms of predictions of who's going to be next and the coining the terms. And number three, what does this mean for a broader global stability? And let's begin with the UK, because number one, obviously on Friday, David Cameron resigned because he staked his credibility on the referendum. And what this does, imagine if the president of the United States was to resign, what that would do. It introduces greater political risk for British politics. In particular, any economic risk that would emanate from the referendum will be blamed on the Tories. Now, that would be a benefit to the Labour Party, but under Jeremy Corbyn, it has turned more left-wing than any opposition party since 1980s. He's having trouble. So British politics are going to be in a roller coaster ride for quite some time. And the last time the Conservative Party imploded over Europe, a Tony Blair-led Labour Party was waiting in the wings. So you're going to see a shift, just as we saw in the U.S. after the financial crisis, a shift from open markets, free markets, to the presidency of Barack Obama, which has been anti-business, high taxation, regulation. Now, here's another thing that has to happen. And we saw that with Cameron's speech on Monday, is Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty. The process of leaving the EU requires a departing member state to invoke the article. And we talked about this gives a two-year period to negotiate an exit that would take account of the state's obligations and future relations with the Union. No country, here's the key point, no country has ever done this before. So it is not clear exactly how this is going to work out. A meeting of the European Council will also need to provide an opportunity for Cameron to announce the country's intention. But the government has an incentive to wait before initiating the two-year countdown process until it has formed a negotiating plan. So you're going to leave. All right. There are both sides, tariffs, trade treaties, laws, banking laws. All of this stuff has been integrated over a 40-year period. And so, you know, the EU is likely to take a hard line with the UK because they don't want to make it easy on them, which would make it easier for other member states to leave. So Article 50 has to be invoked. And as we know, that's not going to take place until October. There's another possibility. There can be another referendum. It is possible because, remember, there was only about a 3-point lead in the poll. And in fact, the likely successor to David Cameron and the Leave vote champion, former mayor of London, Boris Johnson, raised the possibility of a second referendum when he announced his support for the exit. So, in other words, the likely new prime minister and pro-Brexit leader is open to another referendum. Perhaps one could be held after the UK ends its negotiations with the EU. The problem is, we doubt the EU will concede much, since that would lead to a chain reaction in Europe. So the EU has got to be involved. The other thing, a formal withdrawal requires an act of parliament. In 1972, the European Community Act ensures that the UK automatically incorporates EU directives into law, and it's been interpreted. So a lot of British banking laws, financial laws, have been enacted by basically mandates coming out or laws coming out of Brussels. Another issue, and this has been raised in Barron's over the weekend, Felix Zuloff thought this was the beginning of the end of the EU, that it would dissolve itself eventually. Now, last year, you had a Scottish referendum, and the Scots voted 62% to stay in the EU versus England's 53% to leave. So that throws a stark relief the differences in point of views between the two countries. So immediately after the vote, the First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, called for a new referendum. So the failure of Scottish independence referendum in 2014 is not extinguish its desire to leave the Commonwealth. The Scottish National Party has swept into almost total control of the Scottish Parliament since the referendum failed. in Scotland, by comparison with the UK, is in a disproportionate beneficiary of EU transfers. So the loss of Scotland would jeopardize British energy and naval advantages, as well as create internal political risk across the British Isles for the future. And then also, John, this resurrects Ireland. In fact, some of the pundits this week, one in particular on one of the cable channels, talked about in 10 years, we will no longer have Great Britain. You will have simply England and Wales, Scotland and Ireland will be separate countries. So there is a broad implications here that we're going to see. And what happens? Nobody knows, but I want to play a clip from our premium channel. We interviewed Stratfor this week, and basically the gentleman talked about three possible models for the exit of Britain from the EU.
Once a country has notified the EU of its intentions to leave, technically speaking, it has to leave. And we have seen the governments of Germany, France, Italy saying that a decision has already been made and that the UK has to leave. If it does come to a Brexit, then the future of the UK will depend on the kind of agreement it reaches with Europe. As I said before, the British will be interested in keeping their access to the EU market. There's the so-called Norwegian model. We know that Norway is not a member of the EU, but it has full access to the common market, but at the price of participating in the EU budget and following all the EU rules, and the British government may not be interested in that. There's also the Swiss model. We know that Switzerland is not a member of the EU, but has specific agreements on those specific areas where it wants to cooperate with the EU. And then, of course, there's the basic free trade agreement, which I defined as the South Korean model. It's just signing a free trade agreement to allow the UK to export to the EU without tariffs. But that could be limited and could not help the UK in the way it wants. For instance, the UK has a huge financial sector, and we know that there are many non-trade tariffs in the financial sectors, and countries have specific regulations that could make it harder for the UK to export services to the continent.
That was the voice of the guest we had on this week on the premium channel, Adriano Bossoni, who was the European senior consultant for Stratfor. And, you know, as you were discussing there, Jim, a couple of thoughts came to mind. Some people are saying, well, the Great Britain has to leave now. No, it doesn't. It doesn't have to leave until Article 50 is invoked formally. All right. So as you say, there could be another referendum. The First Minister of Scotland was saying, well, maybe we just need to separate from England. Here we go again. You know, remember there was a referendum on that a few years back, because in the northern part in Scotland, they voted overwhelmingly to remain. And so they're not thrilled with the whole thing. The other interesting point is that Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of State, and sort of the voice box for the one worlders are out there, are saying, okay, well, this is the way it's going. What has to happen is that Great Britain and the United States need to come together again in that Anglo-American alliance, which will actually stabilize the current world orders, the way that Henry Kissinger put it, which is interesting because that was the dream of Cecil Rhodes. If you go back to the Rhodes scholarships, that his dream was that there would be this Anglo-American dominance. So it's interesting to hear all of the voices talking about this right there. Okay, three outcomes. What are they right now? We're looking at three possible outcomes as we see it right now, assuming that things stay on this track.
Well, I mean, you have to take a look at a more important question. Who's going to be next? Because there were 28 members of the EU. Now there's 27, assuming that the UK follows through. And to look at that, you know, this has been going on for almost four decades now, that countries have tied their trade policies together. And you have to take a look at who would benefit the most by leaving. And it's those countries that have the least benefit of staying in the union. Now, for example, Greece is widely expected to leave. This is what some of the pundits think, because there's just going to be no appetite to bail Greece out. And somebody's going to have to bail them out, or they leave. Another country that is having some serious trouble is Italy. And it's amazing, since they joined the EU currency block in 1998, Italian economic growth has been around 5% compared to Japan's 14%. So Italy could be in trouble. So you really have to look at, in terms of who benefits the most by remaining in the Union. Now, obviously, Germany is a big beneficiary of this. And the broader implications of this is more of this talk, and that's what we're going to be spending our time, just as we've spent years talking about what the Fed is going to do. Will they raise? When they raise? How much and when? Now we're going to spend, what will Britain do? What will it look like? Who's going to be next? And you've got a lot of political elections going on in Europe, and there's a strong populist movement. And so everybody's going to be guessing, who's the next person? So I would say you would have to look at Finland as a possibility. You would have to look at Italy as a possibility. And then you have to look at the original PIIGS countries. Who's going to want to bail out Portugal and Spain? Or Italy, for that matter. And so, or Greece. So those are likely candidates. And all of this, John, from a broader perspective, weakens the EU's global power.
You know, when you think about it, though, Jim, too, Britain was the second biggest economic powerhouse behind Germany in this whole arrangement. So now the whole thing falls on Germany's back. As you said, people are going to ask the question, well, who wants to bail out all these PIIGS countries? They're weighing the rest of us down. That's driving it. But if we zoom out to geopolitics now, Vladimir Putin in Russia, I think he's probably pretty happy about all this arrangement. Although remember now, at the same time, that NATO continues in existence and the U.S. is formally involved with that, regardless of what happens with the rest of the European Union.
Well, it's even broader than that, because we've seen under Obama the U.S. retreat from its global role as a military power. We've seen it in the Middle East. We've seen it in Afghanistan. We've seen it, you know, in Iraq. You've seen it also in terms of paring down our military. Military budgets have been slashed. The number of ships the Navy has been cut. The number of troops have been cut by almost 500,000. So we're seeing a retrenchment by the U.S., and we're also seeing a retrenchment, which will be the result of these countries leaving the EU. So EU political power and global power will also diminish as U.S.'s political power is diminishing under Obama and could continue in the same direction under a Clinton presidency. So what this does is inject more geopolitical uncertainty. Instead of strong leaders, you know, you had, like during the Cold War, even though there was a risk of a nuclear war, you had two strong superpowers. You had Russia and you had the United States, and it kept the globe in check. Now we go to a multi-global power structure in the globe, and that creates and injects more political uncertainty into the mix. And John, what do markets hate? Markets hate uncertainty. So not only do we have central bank uncertainty with the Fed, we also have now geopolitical uncertainty, and that's going to mean more volatility in the markets. And we'll talk about what this means for investments.
Well, you know, you have to look at some of the rise of nationalism that's going on there. Now, a lot of times it's attributed to xenophobia, but there has been a lot of disruption in various countries. Think of France, think of Sweden, as a result of the wide open immigration policy. And quite often the media have tried to put the quash on this when really large incidents happen, and then they come out anyway. And that's one of the motives, by the way, is that people voted for this because they felt, number one, just like Nigel Farage said in his, what I call his victory lap at the European Parliament, he was saying, you know, you led us here by stealth. You lied to us at a number of steps, and they did. And people are beginning to realize that as to how this moved. But second of all, the disruption seems to go on and the people are treated as collateral damage. So you do have this rise of nationalism, which is threatening this whole thing. And then where it heads from there remains to be seen.
The main reason the United Kingdom voted the way that it did is you have, by stealth, by deception, without ever telling the truth to the British or the rest of the peoples of Europe, you have imposed upon them a political union. You've imposed upon them a political union. And when the people in 2005 in the Netherlands and France voted against that political union, when they rejected the constitution, you simply ignored them and brought the Lisbon Treaty in through the back door.
That was the voice of Nigel Farage, as I mentioned before, in what I call his victory lap at the European Parliament. A member of the UKIP party in Great Britain in favor of leaving, and also a member of the European Parliament. And he had a very interesting 6-minute speech that he gave, which got some applause and a lot of booing from people. All right. What we need to do here now, Jim, is shift into the economic long-term implications, both from economic performance and also from an investment standpoint.
Well, I mean, as we talked about earlier, some of the implications economically and for the markets is definitely lower economic growth, lower interest rates. It's amazing, John, we've done a series of shows here over the last couple of weeks about how low interest rates are historically. And on the day we're doing this broadcast, which is a Thursday, 10-year bonds in Germany are a negative 13 basis points. So basically, when you loan money to the German government, they charge you interest. The United Kingdom's gilts have dropped to 0.86%. Now, we did that show since the founding of the Bank of England, John. They've always been around 3%. Then we did a show. They were down to 1.25%. On this Thursday, they're down to 0.86, down below 1%. France. French bond yields are 18 basis points. Folks, that's less than 0.2% for a 10-year bond. Italy at 1.25%. Spain at 1.16%. Netherlands at less than 10 basis points. Portugal is probably the only high ones. Portuguese bond yields are close to 3%, and Greece bond yields are at 8%. But Switzerland, a negative almost 0.7%. And of course, U.S. 10-year treasuries almost look like junk bonds when you compare this. U.S. 10-year treasuries at 1.46%. You know, you've seen this rush to safety, which is what we saw last week with people going into sovereign bonds. We saw the Japanese yen rise, and you could see the first helicopter drop coming from Japan because obviously the sharp spike in the Japanese yen, you know, they already talked about the Japanese central bank may intervene in the currency markets to stop the yen's rise. Just as the British pound has plummeted, the Japanese yen has risen in this process. So lower interest rates and a stronger dollar. Now, here's the amazing thing. As of this Thursday, over $10 trillion of sovereign debt now has a negative interest rate. And what we're seeing is these massive influxes into the markets with central banks interjecting liquidity, which is one of the reasons why we've seen the stock market bounce back rather quickly here. We're almost at 2100 and we're doing the show on a Thursday. We've got gold prices at 13.25 and we got bond yields, John. I mean, 1%. I remember I interviewed Dr. Gary Schilling, just a little bit about a month on the Premium Channel. And he has long contended in over the last year in the interviews that I've done with him that 10-year treasuries are heading down to 1%. So if you're looking to buy a house, a mortgage, refinance a house, 10-year treasuries getting down to 1% will be the mortgage buying opportunity of a lifetime. But in the short term, the investment implications here are a lower interest rate.
So you do have the central banks then injecting liquidity here in this whole situation. Interest rates are falling. They're getting lower. And if we ask the question, what are we going to do with investments? The real problem you have a rise of populist movements. And politicians, when confronted with challenges, tend to show their best side rather than doing what's best. And that's exactly what Nigel Farage was arguing about. Okay, this is the way it is. Let's make it work for everybody rather than trying to be vindictive. But that also affects investments.
Yeah, I mean, you could see three possible outcomes here. One would be trade protectionism. You're seeing this voiced by Donald Trump. It's a signature of his campaign along with immigration. And that would be bullish for gold and volatility. It would be most bearish for equities and credit because trade tariffs, capital and labor market controls, the constant threat of currency wars are likely to be very negative for corporate animal spirits. I mean, when you're seeing all this volatility, you're seeing protectionist movements. I mean, what you're going to see is a pullback on investment, and that would be bad for not only the stock market and profits and the economy as well, and also probably higher unemployment. A second reaction could be, and we're seeing this, especially espoused by, you know, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, a regressive taxation, higher minimum wage and regulation for a higher bank capital. That would be probably bullish for bonds, especially treasuries and munis, because obviously this would probably lead us into a recession. When you go into a recession, usually stock markets correct. People look for safety. They go into cash. They go into bonds. And where are we seeing, John, we head into a recession. I can't even imagine how low treasury yields can get. I mean, maybe Gary Schilling's 1% on U.S. treasuries may be too high. I mean, we could even go below 1% as we're seeing overseas right now. I mean, when I'm looking at bond yields in United Kingdom below 1%, and France at less than 0.2%, negative in Germany. So higher taxation, which would hurt small business confidence, and that would probably entrench a deflationary expansion. Minimum wage would also increase, would simply exacerbate wage deflation as companies replace humans with robots to keep margins high. Once again, bad economic policies could be the result. The third one, and I predict this is an outcome eventually that we're going to see, and that would be some kind of New Deal fiscal stimulus financed by helicopter money. Because if we go into another recession, what's the Fed going to do? We're at 50 basis points right now on the Fed funds rate. If they cut it back to 0.25% where it was for 7 years, what is that going to do for the economy? What is QE going to do for the economy? It really didn't do much. And so they're really out of a lot of ammo. So what you're going to see, and you've heard it come from Hillary Clinton, I'm sure you're going to hear it from Donald Trump, which is a combination of helicopter drop, lower taxation, a big push for fiscal spending, especially on infrastructure to create jobs, and then the Fed would simply monetize and print the money to pay for it. So eventually, John, we're going to a helicopter drop because we're getting to the end of the tool chest for central banks. Central banks have not been able to revitalize the economy and give us the strong economic growth. I mean, they kept us out of a depression. Granted, they did that. But what else can they do afterwards? They're very limited in terms of what they can do. And so what would happen is I eventually recommend, you know, if Hillary Clinton becomes president, and depending on whether the Republicans hold on to Congress, you're going to see a move to raise taxes even higher, where you have the government taking almost 50-60% of a person's income. So that's going to really hurt the economy, very much like raising taxes did in France and raising taxes did in Japan. And then out of that, then you will see a call for some kind of fiscal stimulus to pull us out of a recession. But higher taxation and regulation would only accelerate the move into a recession, which could very well happen next year.
Well, we should talk about risk, since this whole thing, as you said, could be represented as being somewhat unstable. What are the risks for investors as we move through this whole new period?
Well, I mean, one of them would be lower economic growth in a recession, obviously, is going to impact corporate profits. The economy slows down, sales slow down, companies move to protect margins, that could raise unemployment. Also, you have, especially if we move towards protectionism, that would have a major impact on a lot of multinational corporations that make up the S&P 500 and also the Dow Jones Industrial Average. So you may see a shift in the markets from an investment perspective from large cap stocks to small cap stocks that are mainly domestic, because the politicians would start initiating anti-trade policies, which would, once again, it would be against globalism in multinational companies who, you know, get a good bulk of their profits and sales from overseas. So that would be one shift that you would see. And, you know, eventually, John, if we go that route, you're going to see, and especially with helicopter drops, you're going to see us move, and especially if we head into a recession, from a deflationary environment as we are now in today, it's reflected in bond yields and slower economic growth, to eventually a reflationary environment. Because the one thing that globalization did is it helped to keep a lid on the cost of goods. Companies could move where labor costs were cheaper, and that resulted in lower prices for us as consumers. Same thing when energy prices fell. Consumers paid less at the pump. We, as consumers, pay less for the goods that we import into this country. So that's why, you know, eventually, if this continues down this road, which I think it is, but I think that you're going to see a lot of movement to move towards fiscal stimulus, because it's obvious Europe will eventually find this QE. Japan has already found this with negative interest rates. Monetary policy has reached the end of its limits in terms of its impact. It is more effective when it's combined with fiscal policy. So I think a helicopter drop is coming after a recession in the U.S.
Okay, if that's the situation in which we find ourselves, how are you going to position yourself?
You know, I think a barbell approach to your investment portfolio. In other words, you got to be positioned for reflationary efforts as well as deflationary efforts, because look what we've done over the last 7 years. How many times, remember the crisis, John, we went through in 2011, where the markets basically at one point were down 20%. It looked like we were heading into a recession and we were beginning a bull market, but then eventually the Fed flipped things around with quantitative easing. So we have so many times, and we do this two or three times a year, we go from the risk on to the risk off trade. And so a barbell approach where you have cash, bonds, gold, defensive type stocks, and then on the growth side, you might want to go into what we call uber growth stocks. These are the companies that are immune, either technology or a special economic moat that they enjoy, that they're growing at a fast rate. Think of Uber, think of Netflix, think of Google, think of what we saw in the FANG stocks last year. I mean, just take a look at Amazon stock. So the uber growth stocks would be on the barbell side for growth, because you're going to have to position for both of them, because in a slow growth economic environment, investors will pay a premium for companies that can grow their top and bottom lines faster than the market.
Okay, this may seem old hat, but it wouldn't be a program if we didn't talk about the Fed, especially in relationship to everything we're discussing right here. Let's hear what Janet Yellen had to say here.
To the extent that there are headwinds, I think many of us expect that these headwinds would gradually diminish over time, and that's a reason why you see the upward path for rates. But there are also more long-lasting or persistent factors that may be at work that are holding down the longer-run level of neutral rates. For example, slow productivity growth, which is not just a U.S. phenomenon, but a global phenomenon. You know, obviously, there is a lot of uncertainty about what will happen to productivity growth, but productivity growth could stay long for a prolonged time. And we have in aging societies in many parts of the world that could depress this neutral rate. And I think all of us are involved in a process of constantly reevaluating where is that neutral rate going, and I think what you see is a downward shift in that assessment over time, the sense that maybe more of what's causing this neutral rate to be low are factors that are not going to be rapidly disappearing, but will be part of the new normal.
Fed Chair Janet Yellen talking about headwinds, and I'm wondering how our central bank will wrap its own issues into all of the global uncertainty.
Well, I think one of the first outcomes, and she made reference to this when she was on Capitol Hill ahead of the Brexit vote, is that these global headwinds that she's talking about, prior to that, and certainly now after Brexit, the likelihood of a July rate increase is off the table. So, you know, I don't expect the Fed to raise rates when they meet in July. I also don't expect that they will raise rates in September. And one of the reasons I think that, John, is I think the Fed was surprised at the reaction that they got to that quarter point rate hike in December, where we spent almost the first two months of the year with the markets going down every single week. There's no way Yellen's going to do that 2 months prior to a presidential election. So you can take the September rate hike off. Now, what happens in October? Britain will have a new prime minister, whether they invoke Article 50 and begin the process, and whether Scotland goes. There is going to be too much geopolitical instability here. So I even question whether they're going to raise in December. My bet is no rate hikes for this year. The economy in the U.S. is too fragile. The IMF just issued another report worried about U.S. economic growth and the U.S. economy. You're seeing it in Europe. Europe's economy is very weak. China is going to be a casualty of this movement of reverse globalization because they were one of the main beneficiaries, especially in the last decade. So China's economy stimulus is wearing out. So we could even see a hard landing in China. So, John, I just don't see the Fed going. I mean, a lot of people were questioning why they were doing it in the first place, because we didn't have high inflation. We didn't have strong economic growth with the economy overheating. They were trying to normalize policy. They were saying, look, we have no bullets in the chamber. So the reason we're doing this, in my opinion, is they were doing it because they wanted to reload the chamber with bullets. So in terms of another crisis coming down the road, they would have the ability to respond and do something about it so that there would be something that they could do and fight it with. But they're only at 50 basis points now. That would be a remarkable story if the U.S. heads into recession and in an economic cycle. All the Fed was able to do in an 8-year period was raise interest rates 0.25 point. It would fit in well with the story that we're seeing with the lowest interest rates in recorded human history. I mean, going back to the time of Hammurabi, John, we have never seen interest rates as what we are seeing today. We are truly, truly living in historical times where you're going to see, in my opinion, over the next 10 years, the maps of Europe, the Middle East, and even the possibility they're talking about the United States being redrawn. Believe it or not, there's some movement here in the States talking about certain states seceding from the Union because they're just tired of all the red tape, the bureaucracy, and all the stuff that's going on in Washington. And given the propensity of politicians to make the worst investment decisions because they don't realize the outcome, they really play to the electorate rather than lead and take a look at the consequences of their policy. So it's really, I would say, summing it up, John, I think rate hikes are going to be off the table. I would really be surprised, given the geopolitical instability that have now been introduced and the possibilities that economic growth slows globally around the world, or if the dollar strengthens, which is equivalent to being a tightening, because a lot of central bank policy today is you're seeing the consequences reflected through currency movements, as we just saw with Brexit. So I would say pretty much rate hikes are off the table this year.
Well, if we look in the terms of the presidential election, Hillary Clinton is the establishment candidate, so to speak. She's been leading in the polls, although this is beginning to look like the Kentucky Derby, Jim. We ought to have somebody calling it every day, you know, because it goes up and down. It reminds me of the same thing we discussed when we talked about the Fed. But we had a meeting this week between former President Bill Clinton and Attorney General Loretta Lynch. Senator Sanders hasn't gotten out of this race because he's waiting for the indictment to come down in terms of the email scandal that's going on. But the question now is whether or not some kind of a deal is being cut and if that isn't just going to go away. And so Mrs. Clinton's gaining momentum in the polls. We know pretty well what her policies will be. Regulation, tax, much a continuation of the policies of Barack Obama in many areas.
And if that happens, a weakening economy, you raise taxes on small businesses. And don't forget, John, the full impact of Obamacare is going to go into effect in 2017. And we just did a show for lifetime income that will be aired on Monday. If you make over $85,000 and you are on Medicare in the United States, your premiums can go up 22% next year. Medicare premiums, and also your Medicare deductibles are going to go up 23%, almost 20% on Part D. And also for private insurance policies, they're going to be going up double digits. And then in 2018, you're also going to have Medicare premiums go up for everybody that's on Medicare. So you're going to see rising healthcare costs going up, hitting the economy. And what will happen is you're going to see more and more companies try to keep labor under 30 hours so they don't have to cover. So all of that's going to hit. You throw taxes on that to a weakening economy, John, and we're going to be in a recession, which is why I think in 2017, whoever the president is, we're going to see eventually a helicopter drop where there'll be a movement within Congress led by the White House to strong fiscal spending, which means they're going to blow the deficit out of the water. We could be back very easily to $1 trillion deficits, and the Fed would simply monetize it. So I think down the road, I think the next movement you're going to have to be prepared for is a reflationary movement, because that's what's going to happen. So that, I think, is what investors have to be prepared for: greater volatility and very rapid movements, as we've seen here in the last week alone.
So if we summarize all of this together, whether it's the Brexit, the Nexit, or the Exit, or even the Texit here in the United States, what's really clear is the political maps are going to be redrawn in Europe and the Middle East, as we're watching, injecting a high degree of uncertainty in the geopolitical situation, which will result in political or uncertainty in the markets. And what you're recommending right now is sort of a barbell approach for investors. On the defensive side, high dividend stocks, short-term bonds, gold, cash. On the other side, positioning for a reflation, and that would involve high growth stocks and companies that can grow faster than a slowing economy. Because you do have to recognize that we have probably passed through another watershed, another paradigm shift right now, and it'll take a while for this all to shake out. But analyzing things as we've done, that's pretty much the direction in which we would take it. Well, you know, it's going to be interesting, Jim, because the whole concept of will they or won't they doesn't necessarily refer to the Federal Reserve anymore.
Well, it's going to be great for us because we can actually find something else to talk about other than the Federal Reserve. Now, who's going to be next? Will it be Italy? Will it be Spain? Will it be Greece? Will they or will they not?
And probably will they or won't they raise is going to go the way of the dinosaur for this year anyway, like you said. At this stage, that may become moot based on everything that's happened so far.
Yeah, there's just too many headwinds and too much uncertainty. And, you know, the thing you don't know about this is, what does a lot of uncertainty do? People start getting nervous. They start holding back on spending. They start businesses, especially if, let's say, Hillary Clinton looks like she's rising in the polls. If you're a small business person, you're going to say, wow, she's going to tax the heck out of me. There's no way that I'm going to be investing money and expanding my business because I'm not going to have the money. They're going to take it from me. So anytime you have uncertainty, investors just don't like it. Companies don't like it. What are going to be the regulations that are going to come out of a Clinton administration? How high will tax rates be? There's all kinds of instability. And plus, you have the instability of the world itself, geopolitically. You throw that into the mix, and then all of a sudden, you know, investors do what they do. They pull back and they say, you know what? I don't have any certainty here. I don't have a clear direction of where things are going. I mean, there's obvious things you can do right now to position yourself. And that's why you almost have to have two bets on the table, because these things can shift very quickly, as we saw happen beginning last Thursday. And then look what happened again this week. As quickly as it came down, it went up just as quickly. So those are the things we're going to be focusing on in the weeks ahead. What do we have coming up? Well, we got a Fed meeting in July. I don't think it's going to say much, given the events that have transpired here in the last week or so. We also have corporate earnings coming in. We should have GDP numbers for the second quarter. We'll be getting that next month. And of course, next week, we will have the unemployment numbers, and people are going to pay a lot of close attention to that, especially after the weak May job numbers. Everybody's going to want to see, is this a trend? Because remember, that's the more important thing. People are looking for trends. Is there a continuation of weakness in the economy? That's coming up in the weeks ahead. We'll be here to talk about it. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we hope you have a pleasant holiday weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.